Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 145. It's Monday, January 3rd. Happy New Year, folks. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, the Omicron variant and even Delta are raging across the country. And I've got that feeling again. Reminds me of the Yogi Berra quote, deja vu, all over again. I had it the other day when they had the Colorado Springs, Colorado mayor on NPR, and he was talking about how the hospitalizations have gone down in their community, and it doesn't seem that Omicron is really causing that much problems. Of course, I decided, let me just go and look at what's happening in El Paso County, which is where Colorado Springs is located. And sure enough, they had a nice plateau of basically Delta cases that were pretty high, and they dropped about in half. And of course, this is what preceded their drop in hospitalizations. But if you looked in the last 4, 5, 6 days, less than a week, that drop in half of cases had tripled and ended up being doubling what that original plateau was. And of course, that trajectory is likely to continue very sharply up. Deja vu all over again. Well, and for those of you who keep hearing, if you're like me, when you look at and hear the media, you see a lot about, Omicron being a milder disease. I am very skeptical of that. It may be somewhat, but I don't think there's a lot of evidence that it's substantially less. UK hospitalizations were up 40% in a week. They were looking at the UK because, oh, look, the cases are shooting up, but the hospitalizations aren't going up that much. Well, they're starting to shoot up. U.S. hospitalizations have hit a new peak for children 0 to 17-year-olds and also a new hospitalization peak for 18 to 29-year-olds. It is happening, folks. It just takes a little while for cases to turn into hospitalizations and hospitalizations to turn into deaths. And when deaths happen, it takes a little while to even report them. So you see that actually this last week there was a drop in deaths. Well, this doesn't represent an actual drop in COVID-19 deaths. In the holidays, there's less reporting and there's a delay in reporting, and it takes people to fill out all the death certificates, file them with the state, and there's reporting lags. So expect that to be going up. And even our beloved Dr. Fauci has been kind of annoying me recently. Not that he's saying anything that's specifically untrue, but I think it's a little misleading. Again, about leaning into this that the cases might be more mild when there isn't a lot of good evidence of it. Now, the thing is, if you look at it on a population basis, we have a lot more immunity population-wise. So with the number of cases you're going to get, you're going to get less severe disease per infection. But of course, you're getting many times more infections. You can end up with a whole lot more disease and a whole lot more death. Okay, well, in America, it seems that we love unofficial COVID shutdowns rather than official shutdowns. And you can expect to see a lot of that. On the local front, we had that Springfield Schools announce the delay of restart of school due to staffing shortages. So whether we plan it or not, COVID will shut down a lot of things in our economy. Now, a big wild card that people aren't talking about too much that could be a huge issue, so you may have heard it here first, is China. I reported the last couple of weeks on how China is doing, and they're battling some outbreaks, and they really have a zero COVID policy and are extremely aggressive. Now, I'm not real thrilled with their autocratic ways of doing it, but the reality is they have over a billion people in China, and they have literally about, it's closer to a millionth the amount of cases that we have rather than 10 times. I mean, it's just an astronomically different case. But they are battling Delta, and Omicron is popping up here and there. And we'll have to see if they can fend it off. And part of the problem is that the two most widely used vaccines in China offer little protection from Omicron infection, even with boosters. Now, the reason why this is important is because, as most of you probably realize, supply chain issues around the world are intricately linked to China, a huge producer of all kinds of stuff, including here in the U.S. We're very dependent on it. So keep your eye on China, because if China ends up having huge uncontrolled COVID-19 outbreaks, we're going to see shutdowns worldwide economically, whether we like it or not, official or unofficial. Okay, a little extra reporting on last week. I had a little ditty on the Pfizer COVID-19 antiviral pill and the fact that there's only 65,000 courses of this available now. This week and next week, they'll be going out to localities, and they're hoping to have 200,000 courses of this drug, a good drug, by the end of January. But just to give an idea, to put a little frame on what those 65,000 courses mean, that sounds like a lot. But the reality is we actually have 88,000 pharmacies in the U.S. So that basically means you could not even give one course of this drug to each pharmacy in the U.S. Just a little idea of how little, and because we're not going to get more until a lot later, meaning weeks at months and months, weeks at best, and months most likely to get a good supply of this antiviral pill. And an interesting framing of things, and it's a little bit of a deja vu going back to kind of Trump era. Biden declares that the success or failure of COVID-19 response is up to the states. Now, I feel sorry for him because he's got a tough route. Because we've had such a fragmentation and devolvement of our response that it is up to a lot of state and localities. And he's made a lot of efforts at the federal level to try to shore that up. But if the states don't want it or even work against it, it leads to big trouble for their populations. And if you have huge swaths of the American population that are working against the COVID-19 mitigation strategies, it makes it harder for everybody else. Kind of we're all in it together, unless we're not, and then we're still all in it together. Okay, I want to touch on one more thing that I don't think I'm really hearing in the news, and I've reported on before, but I haven't seen anything for a number of months. But in this pandemic, one of the scientific things that we've discovered is that the severity of COVID-19 cases is associated with the amount of your initial dose. So if you get a big amount, you know, somebody coughs right in your face and you get a big dose of COVID-19, you're actually more likely to have a severe course of that, getting off to a quick start with a higher dose than if you just, say, barely get enough COVID-19 SARS-CoV-2 virus to give you an infection. So the thing that I'd like to see, and that I'm postulating here, now again, this is kind of a hypothesis. I haven't seen any recent information on it, but I do think that one of the reasons why you see such poor outcomes, meaning death ultimately, more severe cases in like the UK and the US, the UK seems to be the most similar to us politically, is because we're willy-nilly and have no cultural consistency, don't even have mask mandates, let alone a cultural belief across the board that wearing masks is a useful thing. So with a lot of non-mask usage, you get both people that are infected coughing a lot more, and obviously you have a lot of people who are willing to receive that without even having a mask to tamp down even the amount. And again, it might not prevent infection, but it could be associated with the amount of severity. This is also one thing that may actually play into the data we're seeing from South Africa. South Africa is a very different culture. They've been very hard hit by COVID-19. They have a national mask mandate that even if you go outside, you have to wear a mask. Anytime you go into public at all, even if it's outside, you have to wear a mask, and people actually are complying with that. So the thing is, even though Omicron is powerful and infectious enough to even get through that type of mitigation effort, it might actually mitigate some of the dose that people are getting when they're getting infected, and it might lead to a little bit, which is kind of what they're seeing, a little bit of mitigation of the severity of disease. Okay, that's a little bit of a hypothesis, but there is some science behind it. I just haven't seen anybody really talking about that or trying to factor that in recently. So that's what we're here about, is trying to take the science and make it real and try to understand the world around us. Of course, I'm going to get to an article in a little bit about upgrading your mask. Okay, but I wanted to close with another Yogi Berra quote, which is that predictions are difficult, especially if they are about the future. I spent a little time this week looking at the CDC's collection of models about where COVID is going to go as far as cases and hospitalizations and deaths. And they're literally all over the place. I found it not really helpful at all. I mean, literally like 2 or 3 dozen different models. And while predictions are hard, especially about the future, there's another saying that does give us a couple elements of how to deal with these great uncertain things that can be potentially threatening. That is, plan for the worst and hope for the best. I think actually we're doing perhaps too good of a job in hoping for the best and not good enough job of planning for the worst. So we got the last half right, I guess. Well, folks, COVID is still raging out there in a viral blizzard. Please take precautions.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me, but the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, folks. Well, in the viral blizzard, you can individually, you and your loved ones, bundle up. And a good way to do that is get an N95 mask. So let's get into some details of that. Practical story from Medical Express. N95 masks, a must-have with Omicron, but fakes abound. You're watching the Omicron variant race around the world and think it might be time to upgrade your mask to a gold standard N95 or KN95 model. A quick search on Google should find you one, right? Not so fast, experts say. According to Ann Miller, executive director of the nonprofit group Project N95, the masks that offer the most protection are indeed the N95 and KN95. Both are approved by the U.S. government to block 95% of the new coronavirus. But she warned that there are a lot of counterfeits out there. The U.S. National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, or NIOSH, tests masks to be sure they meet the standards of what's called filtration rate, she explained. As the pandemic began, lots of masks were submitted to NIOSH for approval as companies sought to cash in on surging demand. Only a few succeeded. Some of those masks were like 20% filtration, Miller noted. In fact, over 60% of the masks that were submitted did not pass NIOSH tests. They did not perform, she said. From my perspective as a consumer, I don't want to shell out my money and get something that I think is protecting me and it isn't. And then I have a false sense of security and then I get sick, Miller added. That doesn't mean all imported N95 and N95 masks are junk, but they all have to meet NIOSH standards, Miller said. Check the numbers. To be sure that any mask you buy is authentic, Miller advises consumers to look for the TC number on N95 masks. It says TC, and then three more digits, and then two digits, and also a lot number, she said. Real N95 masks also come with a head strap. For KN95 masks, Miller said the mask should say GB2626-2019, then a space, and then KN95. If it does not have that printed on the face of the mask, it is not made to the standard. And by the way, I'll give you a link to the website where I have this story so you can take a look at it because there's a lot of detailed information here. Also, the mask could have a brand name on it, Miller said. When you see a mask that just says KN95 and no brand, you have no way to know who actually produced it, and that is not good. Are there other warning signs that a mask might be fake? Miller said one surefire clue is if the labeling claims that the mask is FDA approved or is registered with the FDA. If you see the FDA logo on the box, if you see somebody marketing a product as FDA approved, that is almost a guarantee that it is substandard or a counterfeit product, Miller said in a statement. If you're registered, you've paid $5,400 to be registered, and that's it. The FDA website says the registration does not connote any sort of approval. Also watch out for a mask with no markings at all, no NIOSH markings, or NIOSH, N-I-O-S-H, is spelled incorrectly. Decorative fabrics and any claims of NIOSH approval for children. NIOSH does not approve respiratory products for kids. Cost should not be a factor. Miller stressed that price is not an indicator as to whether a mask is the real thing or not. High-grade masks do not have to be expensive. You can buy a U.S.-made N95 NIOSH-rated respirator for 60 or 75 cents, so you don't have to spend a lot of money, she said. It is important to change masks often as they wear out and become less effective. For most people, it's good to have several masks that can be rotated. Each mask is good for approximately 40 hours of wear. The trick with N95 and KN95 masks is maintaining a good seal. Many people may find an N95 uncomfortable, so they may be better off with a KN95, which has ear loops and may be easier to tolerate. They're not designed for comfort, Miller said. They're designed for performance. Fit is a key. As for other masks, such as cloth ones, Miller said they can be used over a high-grade mask as a fashion statement or to keep a mask clean, but they really don't offer enough protection by themselves. The best way to be sure you're getting a good mask is to buy them from a reliable source. Infectious disease expert Dr. Mark Siegel, a clinical professor of medicine at NYU Medical Center in New York City, stressed that masks are not the end-all and be-all of protection. They can help ward off infection, but they need to be worn properly and changed frequently. By worn properly, I mean a tight fit over the nose. He acknowledged that N95 masks can be uncomfortable to wear and difficult to use, but KN95 or N95 masks do offer the best protection. When we say up your mask game, that means going to a KN95 or an N95 mask. And you can get a link to this article for all those details if you'd like to confirm them. You can go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Okay, well, I've talked about the new Pfizer antiviral COVID-19 pill, which is really good clinically, but the issue is how does it get used in the population? We've got a little insight into how that may work out with this from Stat News. Stat Harris poll. Vaccinated Americans far more likely to take Pfizer COVID-19 pill than unvaccinated people. Just before regulators authorized use of a widely publicized COVID-19 pill from Pfizer, only half of Americans were aware the treatment could prevent hospitalization or death, according to a new survey by Stat and the Harris poll. The survey also found vaccinated people were much likelier to say they'd take the medicine than those who had not been vaccinated. Of those who were familiar with the Pfizer pill, the poll found 84% are likely to take it if they test positive for the coronavirus, with no large differences between generations, racial groups, or political affiliations. But there was one key difference. 91% of vaccinated people would take the pill, but only 52% of all unvaccinated Americans said they were very or somewhat likely to do so. The likelihood an unvaccinated person would take the pill dropped even further to 35% among who said they would never get vaccinated, compared to unvaccinated people who said they will, quote, wait and see. Overall, slightly less than half, or 46% of all unvaccinated Americans, indicated they are unwilling to receive a vaccine or the Pfizer pill. Breaking it down, nearly half of unvaccinated women, millennials, members of Gen X, and Republicans were unwilling to get vaccinated or take the pill if they were to get infected. So, of course, this pill was designed and tested in people that were unvaccinated to prevent severe disease. And we have the oddity, which is perhaps only in America, that those most at risk for COVID-19 are actually the least likely to seek testing or treatment. That is, treatments that work. Okay, next up from Medical Express. Nursing home workers are urged to get boosters as cases soar. Federal health officials last Thursday pressed nursing home workers to get their booster shots amid a spike of COVID-19 cases among staffers and a concerning lag in booster vaccination for residents and staff. Cases among nursing home staffers jumped to 10,353 for the week ending December 27th, a rise of nearly 80% from the previous week, according to data from the CDC. Staff deaths increased to 58, tripling from the previous week. Among residents who are more heavily vaccinated, cases went up slightly, and the data showed no increase in deaths. Well, that's good. With medical experts advising that a booster shot is critical to defend against Omicron, only 57% of nursing home residents and 25% of staff have gotten boosters. That's clearly behind a booster rate of nearly 66% among people aged 65 or older and about 45% of the adult population, according to statistics from the White House. So let me just make that clear again. Those in nursing homes, both the staff and the residents, are actually less vaccinated and boosted than those that are not in nursing homes. Yikes. Nursing home workers were supposed to be fully vaccinated by January 4th under an earlier order issued by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which required staff at healthcare facilities that received government money to get their shots. That directive got ensnared in litigation, and the Supreme Court has set a special session this week to hear arguments on it, along with a much broader Biden administration vaccine mandate for workers at larger companies of all kinds. Together, the orders would affect about 100 million employees. Once again, nursing homes are really the ground zero, said Harvard Health Policy Professor David Grabowski, who has tracked the impact of the pandemic on residents and staff. How well we do in combating this virus can often be discerned by just looking at the nursing homes. Grabowski said the Biden administration is right to raise the alarm now. We see this time and again. When staff infection rates go up, resident rates go up, he explained. Staffers unwittingly bring in the virus from surrounding communities, a common trigger for nursing home outbreaks. Vaccines enabled nursing homes to weather the Delta variant surge earlier this year, and timely boosters should go a long way toward blocking Omicron. The more vaccines and boosters we have, the more lives we are going to save over the course of the winter, Grabowski said. Well, let's turn to some good news. This from Medical Express. 3 days of remdesivir cuts risk for severe COVID-19 in outpatients. A 3-day course of remdesivir resulted in lower risk of hospitalization or death compared with placebo among non-hospitalized patients at high risk for COVID-19 progression, according to a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine. So there's a lot of numbers here, but basically what it comes down to is that COVID-19-related hospitalization dropped by 87% by having this 3-day course of remdesivir. In the campaign towards ending the COVID-19 pandemic, these data add yet another option to the armamentarium for the treatment of vulnerable patients who are at high risk for progression to severe COVID-19, the authors write. And this was actually for people that were given it within 7 days of symptoms, so it's a bigger window than what even the antivirals have. So, and remdesivir is actually cheaper than these antivirals. So that's good news. Hopefully that's something we can get on the ground clinically used sooner than later. Okay, one more COVID-19 story before we get to the local update. And this is a clarion warning call for the long-term impacts of COVID-19. This from Medical Express. COVID-19 can trigger self-attacking antibodies, even in mild or asymptomatic cases. Infection with the virus that causes COVID-19 can trigger an immune response that lasts well beyond the initial infection and recovery, even among people who had mild symptoms or no symptoms at all, according to Cedars-Sinai investigators. The findings are published in the Journal of Translational Medicine. When people are infected with a virus or other pathogen, their bodies unleash proteins called antibodies that detect foreign substances and keep them from invading cells. In some cases, however, people produce autoantibodies that can attack the body's own organs and tissues over time. The investigators found that people with prior infection with SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, have a wide variety of autoantibodies up to 6 months after they have fully recovered. Prior to this study, researchers knew that severe cases of COVID-19 can stress the immune system so much that autoantibodies are produced. This study is the first to report not only the presence of elevated autoantibodies after mild or asymptomatic infection, but their persistence over time. These findings help explain what makes COVID-19 a especially unique disease, says Justin Furtbober, research scientist at the Department of Cardiology at the Heart Institute and co-senior author of the study. These patterns of immune dysregulation could be underlying the different types of persistent symptoms we see in people who go on to develop the condition now referred to as long COVID-19. To conduct the study, the Cedars-Sinai research team recruited 177 people with confirmed evidence of previous infection with SARS-CoV-2. They compared blood samples from these individuals with samples taken from healthy people prior to the pandemic. All those with confirmed SARS-CoV-2 infection had elevated levels of autoantibodies. Some of the autoantibodies also have been found in people with diseases in which the immune system attacks its own healthy cells, such as lupus and rheumatoid arthritis. We found signals of autoantibody activity that are usually linked to chronic inflammation and injury involving specific organ systems and tissues, such as the joint, skin, and nervous system, said Dr. Susan Chang, director of the Institute for Research on Healthy Aging in the Department of Cardiology and co-senior author of the study. Some of the autoantibodies have been linked to autoimmune diseases that typically affect women more often than men. In this study, however, men had a higher number of elevated autoantibodies than women. On the one hand, this finding is paradoxical, given that autoimmune conditions are usually more common in females. On the other hand, it is also somewhat expected, given all that we know about males being more vulnerable to the most severe forms of COVID-19. The research team is interested in expanding the study to look for types of autoantibodies that may be present and persist in people with long-haul COVID-19 symptoms. Because the study was in people infected before the advent of vaccines, the researchers will also examine whether autoantibodies are similar generated in people with breakthrough infections. Okay, well, now is time for the Lucas County COVID-19 update. Well, for context, we have to realize that we're in the middle of it here in Ohio. Ohio has the highest rate of hospitalization for COVID-19 of any state in the United States. And we're at our high for hospitalizations in both Ohio and Lucas County. Well, cases have finally skyrocketed through the roof. The Lucas County average daily number of cases as of January 1st were 527 a day. That's up from 275 in the previous week, so almost a doubling. And that crashed the previous record from last winter of 416 average cases a day over a week. And it looks like it's heading straight up. Testing positivity rates, 23.4% in Lucas County. Well, it's not as bad as the state, 30.8%. Our testing volume locally is holding relatively steadily, just edging up a little bit. But it has gone up a bit statewide, and the testing volume is back up to what we were testing coming out of last surge last winter, last February. But the U.S. testing positivity rate took a huge jump from 9.6% to its most recent 17.1%. Boy, and that's even like reporting from last Friday. And this is like changing every day, just shooting up. And again, these high rates, particularly these in the 20 and 30%, really just shows that the PCR testing, kind of the gold standard for testing, is really being used as confirmation. People are getting a ton of these home tests. Probably a lot of the people that test positive are never reporting it, so they don't even show up in the stats. But those that need or want to seek health care are going to get a PCR test. The physician likely would order that, and therefore you get the confirmation. So those PCR tests are getting jammed up when you're getting 25-30% positivity rates. Okay, nursing home infections went up slightly from 57 to 69 in Lucas County in long-term care facilities. That was 27 residents and 42 staff. That's not the worst we've had recently. It's been held relatively recently. We had a big outbreak a couple weeks ago or so, but we haven't seen the worst of it, and hopefully it won't get a lot worse. Now, we did have a very unusual thing, and I'm assuming this is a reporting problem. Our deaths in long-term care facilities actually went down to 295 from 296. Now, barring a resurrection, I am thinking that this is a reporting adjustment. Okay, well, the bottom line for Lucas County is that our hospitalizations are headed back up steadily, and we have reached record levels, and I don't expect that that's going to get better anytime soon. Okay, let's close the local report with vaccinations. In the U.S., we are up to 62% of the population fully vaccinated. Of course, with Omicron, that doesn't do a whole lot as far as preventing infection, but does a lot for preventing severe disease. So if you look at the number of people that are fully vaccinated, got a booster, it's about a third of people nationwide. And that's just over 20% of the U.S. population has been boosted. In Ohio, it's 55.1% completely vaccinated, and 42.3% of those people have been vaccinated, for a total of 23.3% of the total Ohio population being boosted. And that's similar to what it is. It's the fully vaccinated is a little bit lower at 53.8% in Lucas County, but we have boosted more than both the state, a higher proportion of the people that are fully vaccinated in the state and nationally at 43.3% of those people, which brings our total Lucas County population has been boosted to 23.3%, the same as the state rate. Well, folks, this is Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. This is the People's School of School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, after all that bad news, I'd like to do some better news. This from Conchien Health. Following the science into 2022. Following the science is a catchphrase in wide circulation throughout this past year with good reason. Scientists have been warning us about a number of threats to humanity, and at times we seem to have dismissed those threats. Of course, COVID-19 and climate change are two very prominent examples that come to mind. But many smaller issues come our way every day. And frequently, self-appointed experts step up to dispute what good science tells us is true. Despite all that fussing, though, it turns out that the public globally seems more ready than ever to follow the science into 2022. All we have to do is discern exactly what scientific research is and is not telling us. A new report from the Wellcome Foundation tells us that global trust in science grew during the pandemic of COVID-19. From 2018 to 2020, in global survey research, the proportion of people who said they trust science a lot jumped from 32 to 41%. This rise in trust was greatest among people who said they didn't know a lot about it. So this trend is not one that reflects the viewpoint of elites. A much broader population is driving it. Understanding how the public relates to science is vital for public health, says Laura Clements, Associate Director of Public Engagement and Campaigns at Wellcome. Trust has always been intrinsic to public health, and success can only be achieved when communities are open to and readily understand the science. As such, this vast database can offer huge potential to learn how the public relates to science, particularly during this crucial stage of the pandemic. This study was conducted during 2020 and early 2021. At that point in the pandemic, the public view of science and how the government was using it in the United States was very different from the rest of the world. The U.S. public placed relatively high trust in science generally. Roughly 55% trusted it a lot, but they had very low trust in their government's use of science. In fact, only 21% believed that the U.S. was making decisions based on science. Compare that to Germany, where 63% of the public thought the government was using scientific advice to make policy decisions. These data suggest the U.S. government was way out of line with public health sentiment in the U.S. back in 2020 on the importance of science. Writing for Wired, Max Levy tells us that the pandemic has pushed us toward more scientific literacy. Not only are people increasing their scientific vocabularies, but they are learning important concepts from biology and public health. Students are showing more interest in the roles of scientists and health workers. The messy trial and error of the pandemic is showing non-scientists what the process of science really looks like, and we may all be the better off for it. So despite all the attention that conspiracy theories get, it appears that people all over the world are putting more trust in science. They may even become more tuned to the nuances of it. If that's a dividend of the pandemic, we'll take it. So good news overall, although we seem to be stuck in an untrusting eddy here in the U.S., and conspiracy theories still abound. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real, and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Okay, well, conspiracy theories these days are often associated with right-wing folks, but science is confusing and it gets hybridized, blended with a lot of different beliefs. And genetically modified foods are one of those where it doesn't seem there's a lot of scientific evidence that genetically modified foods are a great health problem. Now, that doesn't mean that they're not a problem. I think that Monsanto trying to patent nature and corner the market in agricultural products is devastatingly unhealthy for the planet and ultimately human health. But if you're looking at, say, the nutritional health impacts of GMO foods, it's kind of overblown. So that's one that probably on the left where we could use a little bit more clarity. But since it has been such an issue, there has been some regulations around it. So I'm going to do this story from Conscient Health. Starting now, no more GMO foods in the U.S. GMO foods have been a source of fiery controversy for a decade. The USDA has pulled off a regulatory miracle. Starting now, January 1st, there will be no more GMO foods in the U.S. None. Instead, we will call them bioengineered. USDA even has a friendly little logo for food companies to slap on their products. Henceforth, labeling a food product as GMO, genetically modified, or genetically engineered is strictly forbidden. But as a consolation prize, food makers can still label the products as non-GMO or non-GE. This amazing regulatory feat comes from a 2016 law, the National Bioengineered Food Disclosure Standard. The goal was to create a single national standard for labeling food products that contain genetically modified, bioengineered ingredients. Vitriolic arguments about disclosure of GMO food ingredients were burning up an incredible amount of energy. Worse, local governments were enacting a bewildering patchwork of requirements for disclosure, creating problems for food manufacturers. Add to that a scientific consensus that GMO foods presently available present no substantive safety problems. Thus, it seems that a lot of energy was going into stirring up confusion about food safety. So this national standard made a lot of sense. But no good regulatory deed goes unpunished. Nobody is really happy with this new standard. Food manufacturers say that the middle of a supply chain meltdown is a bad time to introduce new regulations that affect literally every packaged food product in the U.S., so they'd like to slow it down, of course. Food policy activists are unhappy on several counts. They say there are too many loopholes in the regulations to meet the needs of people who want to avoid these foods. Also, they complain that bioengineered is a term that most consumers don't recognize. And finally, they say that the regs discriminate against more than 100 million Americans who don't have smartphones. That's because food makers can use a QR code that's readable only by the smartphone to direct people to information about these bioengineered products. All in all, this seems like a slightly absurd conclusion to a thoroughly absurd controversy about the safety of food products that almost everyone agrees are safe, fitting for the times in which we live. And to put that debate in context, this also from Conscient Health, there's more than the first world problems of GMO foods and the concern for individual health. A healthy diet is too costly for 3 billion people. The COVID-19 pandemic has caused price spikes for corn, milk, beans, and other commodities. But even before the pandemic, about 3 billion people could not afford even the cheapest options for a healthy diet. Recent analysis of global food price data reveals that as of 2017, the latest available year, around 40% of the world's population was already forced to consume poor quality diets by a combination of high food prices and low incomes. When healthy items are unaffordable, it is impossible for people to avoid malnutrition and diet-related diseases like anemia or diabetes. The researchers compared diet costs to World Bank estimates of what people typically spend on food and the income distribution within each country. It turns out that almost everyone in the United States can afford enough ingredients for healthy meals, such as rice and beans, frozen spinach and canned tuna, bread and peanut butter, and milk. But most people in Africa and South Asia could not acquire enough of these foods for a healthy diet, even if they were willing to spend their entire available income. And in another food and nutrition and ecology story, this from Food Politics, the White House, meat companies have too much power. I was amazed to see the announcement from the White House of all places. Recent data show dominant meat processing companies are taking advantage of market power to raise prices and grow profit margins. In September, we explained that meat prices are the biggest contributor to the rising cost of groceries, in part because just a few large companies, corporations dominate meat processing. The November Consumer Price Index data released this morning demonstrates that meat prices are still the single largest contributor to the rising cost of food people consume at home. Beef, pork, and poultry price increases make up a quarter of the overall increases in food at home prices last month. The big concern is consolidation, monopoly power in the meat industry. Four large conglomerates control approximately 55-85% of the market for pork, beef, and poultry. And these middlemen were using their market power to increase prices and underpay farmers while taking more and more for themselves. Their gross profits have collectively increased by more than 120% since before the pandemic, and their net income has surged by 500%. They have also recently announced over $1 billion in new dividends and stock buybacks, on top of the more than $3 billion they paid out to shareholders since the pandemic began. The bottom line? The meat price increases we are seeing are not just the natural consequences of supply and demand in a free market. They are also the result of corporate decisions to take advantage of their market power in an uncompetitive market to the detriment of consumers, farmers, and ranchers and our economy. Will the Biden administration be able to do anything about this level of monopoly power? Stay tuned. Okay, I got a couple stories here about antibiotic use, which is another overarching story about animal food production. This from Wired. Antibiotic use in U.S. farm animals was falling. Now it's not. New federal data release shows the efforts in the United States to reduce unnecessary antibiotic use in livestock, a persistent generator of drug-resistant superbugs that can harm human health, have lost momentum 5 years after the Obama administration imposed long-awaited rules to control misuse. Sales for animal use are twice as high as those for people. In 2019, the year their analysis stopped, animals accounted for 65.3% of medically important antibiotics sold. That is an extraordinary proportion given that most antibiotics used in animal agriculture are not administered to cure infections, which is what antibiotics are for, but instead as a form of insurance for preventing infections in crowded feedlots and barns. Researchers worked on the working on the topic are dismayed that farm antibiotic use has not been forced down further. Almost no one, though, seems surprised. They say those Obama-era rules, which outlawed using tiny doses of antibiotics known as growth promoters, used to speed up weight gain, were never adequate. If the U.S. is ever going to make significant progress in curbing animal antibiotic use and the superbugs that flow from it, tougher action is needed. We need the FDA to step up, says Matthew Wellington, the Public Health Campaigns Director for the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, which leads a coalition that pressures big restaurant chains to buy meat raised without antibiotic overuse. When they made their initial regulations around growth promotion use, we told them that's not going to be enough. You have to completely eliminate routine use of antibiotics and make sure that the drugs are only used to treat sick animals in very limited circumstances. That's a big task, but there's evidence that it's possible. The European Medicines Agency announced last month that between 2011 and 2020, farmers in the European Union cut antibiotic use by 43%. The bloc outlawed growth promoters in 2005 and is set to enact a ban this year on giving antibiotics to livestock to prevent future infections. That would restrict European farms to only using antibiotics to treat sick animals, the way we use antibiotics in people. And, according to researchers, the only way that balances the benefits of a cure against the risk of provoking resistance. Cutting use on U.S. farms down to that stringent EU standard is a long-sought goal, but given the new FDA data, it may be out of reach. Maybe a little context is in order. It's been clear since the 1940s that resistance, which broadly speaking describes mutations that allow pathogens to diffuse drugs' attacks on them, arises whenever antibiotics are used. It's evolution in action. If you expose an organism to something potentially lethal, but you don't kill it outright, it can develop defenses to protect itself the next time. Resistant bacteria have gotten very good at defending themselves. Each year, they kill an estimated 700,000 people around the globe, according to the World Bank, a number that has been predicted to rise to 10 million by 2050. Estimates of annual U.S. deaths range from almost 49,000 people to more than 162,000. Plus 2.8 million non-lethal infections. The World Health Organization's most recent global report identifies approximately 3 million infections per year globally, but that's considered a vast undercount, as it includes only 70 nations whose surveillance systems are up to the task. Even during the COVID pandemic, the World Health Organization called resistance, quote, one of the biggest threats to global health, food security, and development worldwide. Because the volume of antibiotics given to farm animals outstrips what is used in humans. That makes agriculture a petri dish for breeding resistant bacteria. Hundreds of studies have shown a clear connection. Those bomb-proof pathogens harm livestock, cut into farm productivity, and sicken people, crossing to us via meat and manure and through the environment. It's also clear that when farmers stop using so many antibiotics, the incidence of resistant bacteria diminishes. In just one example, the Canadian government mandated cuts in farm antibiotic use in 2014, and by 2019, resistant foodborne bacteria dropped by 38%. The new federal data does hold one bright spot. The 2020 report reveals that all of the antibiotics sold for agricultural use raising chickens, the most commonly consumed meat in the U.S., accounts for only 2% of the drugs. That compares to 41% each for cattle and hogs and 12% for turkeys. It represents a complete turnaround for the U.S. chicken industry that began in 2014 when Purdue Foods, then the nation's fourth largest producer, announced it was taking its entire operation antibiotic-free. Only 1% of broiler chickens in the U.S. are produced with what the industry calls full-spectrum antibiotics, Wellington says. And more than half are raised no antibiotics ever. That's incredible, but it means that we're at a standstill with pig and cattle production. It's urgent to keep forcing down antibiotic use because research increasingly showing how far-reaching the influence of farm antibiotics may be. It's been clear for a year that resistant infections are affecting people being treated for COVID-19. And also increasing the stress on overwhelmed hospitals. Scientists believe some of those infections, particularly resistant fungi, emerge because of agricultural antibiotics. Research published in September shows that when farm antibiotics get into soil from direct dispersion or via manure, they interfere with microbial communities and reduce carbon storage. Well, folks, just another way that animal food production is killing the planet and us humans. And further on this story from The Independent in the UK, antibiotic use on farms threatens pandemic much bigger than COVID, campaigners warn. Overuse of antibiotics on farm animals could lead to a pandemic much bigger than COVID, campaigners have warned. Farmers often give animals a preventive low dose of antibiotics as an insurance policy against disease. But from January 28th, new EU legislation will prohibit all forms of routine antibiotic use in farming, including preventative treatments. The government's Veterinary Medicines Directorate has begun a consultation about whether the UK should follow suit. Use of antibiotics on farmed animals has decreased significantly over the past few years, a 52% reduction since 2014. But campaigners say this does not go far enough. They are calling on the government to follow the EU and ban the practice of giving the drugs to healthy farm animals. The UK's Health Security Agency warned last month that antimicrobial resistance was a hidden pandemic. While the World Health Organization has estimated drug-resistant diseases could kill 10 million people globally each year by 2050 if no action is taken. Lindsay Duncan, the UK campaign manager at World Animal Protection, said the coronavirus pandemic has shown how the issues emerging in one country were not confined there. If there are one or two bad players, it's still going to cause a problem for the rest of the world. It's not just the case of the European Union doing the right thing. We all need to be doing this and putting it in this legislation. This is going to be the next major pandemic, and it's going to have a really big effect on people. Ms. Duncan said antimicrobial resistance was actually going to be much bigger than COVID because the problem could not be solved with vaccines. We can't just produce vaccines for bacterial infections. These medicines have allowed us to live the way we do, having amazing life expectancies, heart transplants, major surgeries, and recover well from them. She warned, if antimicrobial resistance continues growing in the way that it is right now, we are going to lose one of our most powerful medications. There is no fix for that, so it has to be addressed now.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, next up, another story on how the environment affects our health. This from Vox. How humans could live 2 years longer. You can't see particles smaller than 2.5 microns, but they kill 3.4 million people a year. The University of Chicago's Air Quality Life Index, which regularly estimates the human toll of particulate pollution, this fall issued a report estimating that the average person on Earth loses 2.2 years of life expectancy due to particulate pollution, compared to a scenario in which every country followed World Health Organization guidelines. Alcohol use reduces life expectancy by 9 months. Unsafe water and sanitation, 7 months. HIV/AIDS, 4 months. Malaria, 3 months. And conflict and terrorism, just 7 days, researchers Kevin Lee and Michael Greenstone write in the report. Thus, the impact of particulate pollution on life expectancy is comparable to that of smoking, almost 3 times that of alcohol and drug use and unsafe water, 5 times that of HIV/AIDS, and 114 times that of conflict and terrorism. By their count, lowering air pollution levels below those specified in World Health Organization guidelines would enable people currently alive to enjoy 17 billion more years on Earth collectively. And that's a relatively conservative figure. Shortly after the report's release, the World Health Organization set stricter guidelines for particulate pollution. Its prior standard, undergirding the University of Chicago analysis, was that particulate concentration in the air we breathe should be kept under 10 micrograms, or a millionth of a gram per cubic meter of air. The new threshold, developed due to the evidence that even lower concentrations can be harmful to health, is half of that. 5 micrograms per cubic meter. Cutting global air pollution down to that new lower threshold would save even more millions of life years. And the harms of particulate pollution are not limited to life expectancy. Patrick Cullison, the entrepreneur and co-founder of Stripe, has taken a research interest in this topic and has a useful compendium of recent work on air pollution harms among the studies he highlights. A very small increase in particulate pollution, specifically an increase in particulate matter 2.5 concentration of 1 microgram per meter, causes, by one estimate, a 0.8% reduction in GDP that year, mostly because air pollution increases absenteeism and reduces productivity. Alzheimer's diagnoses triple when long-term air pollution exposures substantially increase by 10 micrograms per cubic meter. Parkinson's and dementia diagnoses increase as well. Air pollution reduces cognitive functioning in young people. Applying U.S. air pollution standards to China would substantially raise test scores on both reading and math in their country, from the median to the 63rd and 58th percentiles, respectively, for reading and math. Chess players, baseball umpires, and stock traders have all been shown to perform worse at their jobs when exposed to more air pollution. Those jobs are unusually easy to quantify, but it stands to reason that people's performance at other jobs suffer too. Even if air pollution doesn't kill you, it probably impedes your cognitive functioning, makes you poor, and increases your susceptibility to brutal diseases like Alzheimer's. And, of course, air pollution does not affect everybody equally. Example of that, this from Medical Express. Policy analyses severely underestimate impact of air pollution on racial minorities. In the United States, federal regulators manage air pollution primarily due to its effects on human health and mortality. Current regulatory analyses assume that all people are affected equally by air pollution. A new study estimated the mortality impacts of air pollution using information specific to race and ethnicity. Factoring in racial and ethnic differences in underlying health and vulnerability to pollution, increased premature mortality estimates related to particulate matter 2.5 from pollution exposure to all sources by 9% in people older than 65 years, accounting to a $100 billion difference from currently used estimates of mortality costs in the U.S. But the differential impact across race was much larger. Considering these differences across race and ethnicity boosted the estimate mortality impacts on older Black Americans by 150% and on Hispanic Americans by 52%, the study concluded. The authors note that their study is limited by the geographical aggregation of data at the county level. They point out that intra-county concentrations of particulate matter 2.5 may vary significantly, and Black Americans are generally more likely to live near highways and other major sources of emissions. Based on our results, we recommend that the best available and most up-to-date race ethnicity-specific information be used in regulatory assessments, especially those related to estimating the health effects of policy changes, to identify and reduce environmental injustices of air pollution, suggests Elisheba Spiller, the lead senior economist at the Environmental Defense Fund, who led the study. Okay, well, lastly, I would like to do a story that basically has to do with the beginning of this year, and looking back at this pandemic and some of the things that we've learned in public health. There's some things to be grateful for, but to reaffirm the foundations of public health. This from the editorial board of the American Journal of Public Health, reaffirming the foundations of public health in the time of a pandemic. First, we lean on the definition offered by the Institute of Medicine, according to which, quote, public health is what we as a society do collectively to assure the conditions for people to be healthy. Second, public health must centrally be concerned with health equity, with ensuring that all can live long, healthy lives. That we have a deeply unequal country on axis of health is indubitable, and the gaps between health haves and health have-nots have only widened during COVID-19. This elevates the importance of focusing on the core purpose of public health to narrow these gaps. Third, public health must stand on the side of those who are marginalized and vulnerable, and whose health stands most to benefit through improvements to the conditions that generate health. According to the 1908 Universal Declaration of Human Rights, quote, everyone has the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of themselves and their family. It is the role of public health to focus on the everyone in that definition, turning our attention in particular to those individuals who are often left behind by other broader societal efforts. We consider these three core purposes of public health: a focus on the conditions of the world around us, on eliminating health inequity, on those who are marginalized and vulnerable, foundational to the field. This has, in our assessment, been the case since the origins of public health, has continued to be so during COVID-19, and will continue to be so for decades forth. A refocus on these forces can help sharpen our priorities and remind us of why we do what we do, even when we are living through the maelstrom of ideas occasioned by a global pandemic. And I'll just take this time to give you one of my New Year's resolutions, which is to keep fighting a good fight for health for all people in all communities, and a just planet. And there's always more to do and always more to learn. So we get to the bonus articles. There's 10 this week, which you can read online. And I'll give you the link at the end. Number one, 10 lessons I've learned from the COVID-19 pandemic from a science writer. Two, why do we feel so blah after Christmas? Three, how to purge risky chemicals from your beauty products. Eliminating endocrine disruptors is harder than you might think. Four, the USDA's new labeling for genetically modified foods went into effect January 1st. Here's what you need to know. Five, big cars are killing Americans. The government can no longer allow the auto industry to treat walkers and bikers like collateral damage. While traffic crash deaths have gone up, pedestrian and biker deaths have gone up way faster. Six, how black communities become sacrifice zones for industrial air pollution. Seven, deaths of despair, the unrecognized tragedy of working class immiseration. There's your big $3 word for the day, immiseration. Eight, leaked Southern California hospital records reveal huge automated markups for healthcare, which is not unusual, it's commonplace. Nine, Nuclear Regulatory Commission's foot dragging on patient irradiation suggests regulatory capture. In other words, when there's an accidental application or injection of radiated substances, they're often not told to the patient or reported to regulators to track. 10. Very interesting article. We need to talk about climate change and suicide. There's a lot of connections, and this is a very interesting read. You can read that and others and all the stories that I've talked about on this show at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.